You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we don't see color, we see how much of an asshole you are. Predictably, much has been made over the tragedy in Charleston. And don't get me wrong, it's a major tragedy, but the way this is being approached is very distressing to me. I'd like to focus in on one commentary in particular, and the commentary I'm referring to is Jon Stewart. Using his newfound freedom, sort of like tenure as a college professor, he decided to not be funny on The Daily Show and instead sort of rant a little bit, and maybe it wasn't really a rant, but he decided to talk a little bit about what happened in Charleston, about the white young man who went into the church and the black church and shot and killed 9 people. And he labeled it an act of terrorism and pointed to it as evidence of the racial divide and racism that still exists in this country. Obviously, we could pick apart the fact that he's calling it terrorism and that underplays what we actually call terrorism, and not being able to distinguish between the two, and not being able to distinguish between foreign threats and domestic problems. But there's a greater issue to me in this entire debate, in this entire conversation that's being talked about. People look at Roof, the guy who did it, as somehow an example of Southerners and an example of white people, rather than looking at him as an individual and figuring out why he did what he did. The response and conversation to this tragedy demonstrates one thing. There is an undercurrent of collectivism in this country that is the true problem that is tearing us apart. We do not see people as individuals and take their motivations as individuals. We assume everything is part of broader groupthink, and that leads to things such as racism. The best way to fix issues like this is look at yourself first and make sure that you are dealing with others as individuals, and then you can talk to them and make sure they are dealing with you as an individual. Joining me this week via Skype from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. How are you, Daniel?
Well, I feel like I'm not joining you from our nation's capital this week so much as I'm joining you from our nation's capital of collectivism. But otherwise, I'm fine.
So you're in agreement with what I was saying then?
Yeah, well, of course. How could I disagree with the host of the show? I think it was best summed up, and I think there is the collectivism thing going on. On top of that is there's this narrative ideology thing going on. Best exemplified by the 2 tweets from Salon that have been making the rounds, the first of which was recently, and it said, "White America needs to answer for the Charleston shooting," and then the tweet from 2013 that said, "Muslims don't need to answer for the Boston bombing." I think it's just everyone's trying to play to whatever they think gets them the shortest term advantage.
Well, yeah, there's certainly that as well. There's the pragmatism where people are just trying to get clicks in today's day and age, right? Everything is clicks. Who clicks on your website? Who pays attention to you? But even in those tweets, there's the assumption of collectivism. White America needs to pay. Not this guy needs to pay. Likewise, Muslims don't need to pay for what was done. When we're talking about, and I'm talking about America, when we're talking about internal problems, we need to begin from individualism, because that's what this country was founded on. But when we're battling foreign enemies who think like collectivists, we need to treat them that way, because that's how they're treating themselves. And that's the distinguishment we need to make between what this country was founded on and what we're supposed to be about and what foreign threats are about.
Hear, hear.
Also joining us via Skype from the House of Mouse of Collectivism, Elliot Rivera. How are you, Elliot?
I'm actually partially inspired by the reaction of the people in Charleston and the way that the community has kind of resisted rioting and resisted these calls to, you know, to anger and incitement of violence. The citizens there in that community have really exhibited a lot of grace and a lot of dignity, and I completely applaud them. And never again can any leftist from any blue city, blue state, look down on the South, and particularly South Carolina, and sneer about people being backwards or being hicks or being uneducated when they have exhibited much more grace and class than anybody in Baltimore or even in Ferguson exhibited.
Agreed. And unfortunately, this is where the debate over God comes in, because then people in the red states will say, well, people in the blue states only do that way because, only act that way because God has been taken out of their equation.
Well, I won't speak to that, but the people have certainly, I mean, I don't know how, maybe, I mean, many of them probably are very religious, but I think that it's a really a cultural thing. People understand, at least in that community, you know, that the focus needs to be on, you know, on rebuilding ourselves as individuals, and through that potentially helping to rebuild the community, and by resisting the urge to collectivize into these angry riotous mobs.
Agreed. And speaking of collectivism in a way to rebuild and reclaim our culture, it's time for the news with Daniel T. Richards.
To celebrate the 100th anniversary of the country recognizing women's right to vote, the United States Treasury is unveiling a redesigned $10 bill in the year 2020, so don't rush out to try to get any, bearing the visage of none other than a woman. Not a white male, but a woman. The Treasury wants to find a woman who, quote, makes a statement about who we are and what we stand for as a nation. Twitter and Facebook were all abuzz this week with suggestions that ranged from Eleanor Roosevelt all the way to Eleanor Roosevelt. But we at the Midside have a different suggestion.
A better suggestion.
The best.
The greatest fucking suggestion. Dear United States Treasury, your search is over because we have your perfect 10, and that is Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand. A strong-willed, talented woman who escaped communist Russia to celebrate democratic America by composing compelling fiction and nonfiction that featured beautiful, intelligent, and strong female protagonists, so writes Justin Lesneski over at themidside.com.
Hey, you took my joke. I was going to say those words sound pretty good. Where'd you come up with them?
I did not come up with them. You, in fact, came up with them. So it struck me when I read this article that Ayn Rand would, or I'm sorry, it struck me when I heard this news that Ayn Rand would be the perfect candidate for this, and I sort of posted about it on my Facebook page, and then Justin called me in some fervor like I've never heard before in my life, like, oh my god, we have to make this a movement.
That's not true. That was nowhere near when we won the Super Bowl.
Frothing at the mouth.
Come on, you heard me after we won the Super Bowl. This was not near that.
Okay, right. You weren't crying and cutting yourself, but you were definitely rabid.
That's a good idea.
It is a good idea. I agree. So that night, I started a Facebook group through the Midside Facebook page called Put Ayn Rand on the $10 Bill.
Facebook
and the next
event.
Morning. Yeah, what did I say? Group?
Yeah.
God, I think I do this for a living. And the next morning I woke up to an article that Justin wrote, sort of outlining exactly why we think Ayn Rand would be great for the 10. I also woke up to a bunch of Orthodox objectivists calling me the most evil person who has ever lived for dare suggesting that she could put on some fiat currency that she would have hated. Sort of similar to how she would have absolutely hated being on a stamp, for instance.
I have not seen the word fiat used more than in the past week.
True that.
To me, fiat was always a car.
You are not an economist. I know this about you. You are good with your money, but you definitely don't have this economic theory stuff at the ready. But fiat currency is the kind of currency that isn't tied to an objective value.
I understand like our what money. It means.
Yeah, it's not little car currency. It's not the money you use to buy Italian overpriced vehicles.
I thought everyone was just referencing the movie Cars, and that was the name of their currency in that movie.
Hilarious, but no. But no, keep Pixar in mind for later.
This is honestly one of the times where I really don't want to call myself an objectivist for this reason. I'm gonna piss off some people right now and lose part of our audience probably, but this is the time where I think these people are disconnected from reality. And the reason I say that is, Ayn Rand is dead. I do not give a shit what Ayn Rand would want. I care about what my values are and what the best way to forward them are. And that's to use her image symbolically for what she stood for symbolically. I understand that the economy is not great. I understand that the country is not ideal. But I have to deal with what the country is and make that work with what I believe in. And that's not pragmatic because I'm not just trying to get the best results in the moment. I'm making a decision that I think will affect the culture in the long run. And I think her being on the 10 and forcing people to look at her and wonder who she is and what she thought will make people read, above all, first of all, the money speech, which will open the door to people going, oh, I'm the root of money, which will make people start taking more personal responsibility for A, their money, and B, their work.
Hear, hear. That's beautiful.
Yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There are a lot of things that Ayn Rand wouldn't have wanted that we have done that other people don't seem to have a problem with, like I don't know, the movies, you know. How about the Ayn Rand Institute, which I think she would have been appalled by.
Shots fired.
But I think she said as much. I don't remember exactly where she said it, but she basically said, there's not going to be a formal objectivist movement in my lifetime, because basically I am it. And that's the end. When she's dead, Peikoff was like, nah, she's dead. Let's go ahead and do it. And I think it's been an overall good thing for the culture. So
well, that's
we
twisted
can't...
around.
I think it is a good thing. I just, my point is to support you, for once, that we can't care about what Ayn Rand would have wanted.
Well, because she can't have wants. Right, it's impossible to know what she would have wanted. So much has changed contextually. Who knows what her views would be now?
Yes.
It's a little fucking arrogant. How about this, to piss more people off? It's a little fucking arrogant to sit here and go, what I think is exactly what Ayn Rand would have thought, because I think exactly like Ayn Rand thinks. Like, who the fuck are you? To say that about any other human being is fucking absurd. If I were to sit here and go, I think exactly what Dan would think. You know, I'm going to use one of Belichick's principles now. Speak for yourself.
Oh, man, that guy's brilliant in so many regions. Also, Drew, how long did it take to mention Belichick? You mark that down. We're going to put on a graph one day.
I agree with Justin, though. This really is a symbolic of a big problem within objectivism. And why, like, I really just don't want to deal with this movement anymore, in a lot of ways anymore either. Because a lot of these people, I'm going to offend some people now. Don't you guys get the sense that a lot of objectivists are neurotic about one thing or another?
I get it. Well, here's my only counter to you at all. So the answer is yes. But I also encounter everyone else in the world who are also mostly neurotic about something. But I think the pronouncement in objectivism is maybe a little bit more, only because they're a little more intense.
Right, yes. And that's the thing, is that's the irony that I find, is I identify the same problem you do, Elliot, but it seems to be more obvious in objectivists because all objectivism seems to have done for them is heighten that thing, rather than give them some sort of, I don't know, calm, inner peace. I don't know how I want to describe it because I don't want to sound like a fucking Buddhist, but you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's this, well, I mean, any ideological group, the smaller the group, the more rabid the fans, I think, are going to, or the believers are going to be.
Right.
I think that's true in any movement. And I think that's the big problem right now. You have a lot of very rabid people who are very intense and very protective. And because of that, they turn people away. What we need to be doing, and the three of us have discussed things like punk rock objectivism, these ideas about being a movement that's not just about the philosophy, but about its application in pop culture and in the culture at large. and why philosophy and why ideas are important and how culture really is rooted in ideas. And right. I think if you become too dogmatic, you miss out on that.
Right, and I think the best way to do it here is we just need to caution ourselves. And remember, we don't want to make the mistake of not talking about objectivists as individuals either, because I could very easily see somebody saying, you did that whole opening monologue, and then you talked about us as a group. So I want to be clear that we're not doing that, and I think the best way to describe it is my old roommate that Daniel also knows well, who's a very, very smart person, identified, I think, the problem pretty succinctly when he said, the issue is when you define your entire identity and define your identity around labels such as objectivist or, you know, even saying you're a football fan or a Patriots fan or whatever you are. You have to be yourself first, and then once you know your values, appreciate them in reality and take on those labels, but don't be primarily those labels. And that is a very subtle difference, but I think that's a lot of the problem here is when a person, and we see it across many people, when a person takes on the label of objectivist as the primary of their identity rather than saying, this is what I am, this is who I am, and this is what I think. Oh, and that lines up with this label objectivist, or with myself, this lines up with that label of Patriots fan.
Yep, I think even Leonard Peikoff has pointed that out in a few places, as well as Ayn Rand. I forget the exact word she uses. It's something like witch doctor objectivist, or I'll have to look that up. But basically she said too many objectivists are concerned about what you should think versus what you do think and why you think that.
Right, and I think this whole thing is an example of that, isn't it? What should we think of an objectivist as this? Oh, well, of course we should be against putting her on there because she wouldn't want that. No, just think of reality first, then think of what you want to do.
I mean, she dramatizes this well in Atlas Shrugged. I mean, when they tell Dagny Taggart, we seek to convince, we don't try to force, you know, we seek to prove, not just tell or to, you know, I mean, that's really the ethic that is involved here. If you're right, then you're right. Reality is going to bear you out. Don't be, you know, you don't have to be that intense unless a particular situation calls for it. But most of the time people, I mean, and I think I've commented on this before, sometimes objectivists will jump on somebody on Twitter or on Facebook who's actually asking a very intellectually honest question, and they'll just be dismissed as if somebody smacked them with the back of their hand, you know, mobster style. I mean, so I don't know. You know, people just, I mean, just if you're right, then you know you're right. Be relaxed, be confident, and know that reality is going to bear you out.
Well, that being said, do love me some objectivists a lot of the time.
Right, and the whole point of this, let's not forget this, the point is, it's right for Ayn Rand to be on the $10 bill because of what she stood for, what she understood about money, and what she understood about America and what America stands for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't necessarily want to alienate 98% of our audience. So, now that we've thrown all objectives under the bus,
I'm
only speaking at OCON. if you're attending the Objectivist Conference, I'll be speaking on a panel about social media. So come tell me to go fuck myself, and then we can get on with our lives.
Although I do want to be clear that I don't think you have much of a concern about that, Daniel, because most of our audience has been pretty quiet about supporting us in this endeavor, which is something that happens when you have I mean, we talk about this all the time with the way social media is used by social justice warriors and such, and you know, any sort of loud group of people, the people who disagree with the loud group, even if they're right and they know they're right, don't speak up because, as Elliot's saying, one, they want to be calm because they're just like, I know I'm right. And two, they just don't want to get involved with it and, you know, be insulted and deal with the abrasiveness of it. So I don't think we'll lose a lot of our audience.
I don't think so either. We probably already lost them. It's fine. Although we do have now two people funding us on Patreon, which is amazing. We want to give a shout out to both Teresa and Mark. Thank you so much.
It's awesome being professional podcasters.
Now we are professional podcasters because of you. And if you want to join in on that, you can go to patreon.com/themidside and you can support us any way you want. One penny per episode, $100 million per episode, whatever we're worth to you.
Do I really have to go into the outro already? That was really early for the plug.
Yeah, have a day. Okay, moving on.
My mind. There.
Speaking of things that people will like, South Park fans, rejoice! There will be a sequel to the popular South Park RPG The Stick of Truth called South Park The Fractured But Whole.
And that's B-U-T space W-H-O-L-E.
Yeah, what did you think I said?
The Fractured Butthole.
You're gross. You have a dirty mind, sir.
Did either of you play the original game, The Stick of Truth?
I have not played a video game since The Legend of Zelda.
Link to the Past, that's, right?
It's not true. But
I love Link to the Past. It's my favorite.
I have not played anything on Xbox, PS4, or any of those kind of consoles. So I did not play the original Star Park? What's that called? South Park RPG.
Now, we're big fans of the South Park here in the Midside, right? Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
I have not played video games for a long time either, but I played South Park The Stick of Truth. And I think if you're a South Park fan, it is a game that needs to be played. And I think there's even more reason to be excited about the sequel. Because the original game is basically like a huge extended episode of the series. So, the controls aren't that in-depth, so if you're looking for like an in-depth Final Fantasy-style RPG, look elsewhere. But if you're looking for lots of references to things that happened in the series and a plot line and storyline and dialogue written by Trey Parker and Matt Stone, it's definitely a game to play. You also get to walk around the entire town of South Park, which is really cool, and go to all the different areas, and you meet the crab people. You meet Mr. Hanky, you do all these different things.
Crab people.
You fight Al Gore, you fight Man Bear Pig. So it's really, if you love South Park, you're going to love the game. And I think that the second game will be even better because Trey Parker and Matt Stone said, we didn't really learn how to make a video game until we were almost done making the first game.
Yeah, I watched a little clip of them discussing the new one, and they basically came out and said, we weren't going to do this ever again because it's really, really hard. But by the time we got to the end, we were like, wow, we know so much now about how to make a game cool and how to add more features to it that we might as well do it again.
And that excites me because the one thing I was sort of disappointed in is I felt like there could have been more. And I felt like they left a lot of opportunities on the table. Not that I necessarily know how to make that because I don't. I'm like them. I would be the same way. But when I was playing it, I was like, I feel like a game made by somebody else would have had this extra stuff in it.
Yeah.
And also, I want to say that comment, I think, reflects them so well. That they weren't going to do it again, but they got to the end and they were just like, fuck, we can do this better, which means we have to. Because they would hate themselves if they didn't.
Yeah. Absolutely.
This was, of course, announced during E3, right?
Yes.
And there was a couple other big releases big mentions during E3 was they're gonna do a Final Fantasy VII remake, which we'll get to in a second, Daniel, because there's a question I want to ask you after I get to the end of this. And they're also gonna do a Kingdom Hearts 3, and Kingdom Hearts is of course the Final Fantasy meets Disney game, which is also really, really good. I played Kingdom Hearts 1 and 2, and you travel to all the different worlds. But
were you Aladdin?
Yeah, you can be Aladdin too in it.
Is that all you were?
No, because you can only be Sora, the main character, but you like go to Agrabah and fight in Agrabah. So that's really cool. And he joins your team.
Like glitches where you go behind the curtain with Jasmine?
No, but that would be awesome.
That's like your fantasy.
Yes. That is reserved for, the stolen Oculus Rift. The stolen intellectual property of Oculus Rift. South Park The Stick of Truth gets a sequel, Final Fantasy VII gets a remake, and Kingdom Hearts gets another sequel. Daniel, do you have a problem with this?
A little bit. I mean, there was a time, I remember, when I was a youngin, where new video games were created. And we liked it. I mean, I don't have
that
as much...
That was a really obscure reference that only I would get, by the way.
Indeed. And I don't have as much of a problem with the video game industry doing this as I do with the movie industry, partially because the video game industry, you're participating in a story, but you're participating in a game first. And the game can be an updated version of the previous game. It can be an addendum to the previous game. It can be a reboot of the previous game. But it's still a game. A movie is a standalone piece of art. And we don't need to see basically the same concept over and over and over and over again, because it's not a participatory medium in the same way that a game is.
So you're saying it's like sports, where you play basically the same game over and over again, but it's different because of your free will and your input into it.
Correct. Yeah. So while I do think they should try to focus on making new and interesting games, I'm less pissed off about it. Also, I don't play video games anymore, unless it's Words with Friends. Do not add me. I will not play you on Words with Friends. I am better than you.
I was waiting for it.
I will not play you.
All right, let's move on to something original then, right?
Something original! Entertainment Weekly box office report, Inside Out scores biggest original debut ever with $91 million.
For Pixar, so, you mean?
Biggest original ever.
Well, I guess Jurassic World doesn't count, because it's not original. But what, Avengers, I guess Avengers is a sequel.
Yeah, that's keep naming them.
That's interesting.
Yeah, keep naming them. It surpassed the 2009 opening weekend of Avatar, which made $77 million.
Really?
Yeah.
I feel like I should be upset about that, but I'm not. That's because that's how much I hate Avatar.
It's true. So $91.9 million North American ticket sales, giving you the largest opening ever for an original story. But it still did not beat Jurassic World, which made $102 million. This is the first time Pixar has debuted at number two.
Well, and Jurassic World had the number one opening weekend of all time. So it's not like they're getting their butt kicked by, you know, nobody here.
Jurassic World has already earned $981 million.
I can't wait for 15 years from now where they do Jurassic Universe and it's the same movie as Jurassic Park and Jurassic World.
Dinosaurs in space!
Dinosaurs in space! Yes!
So, sorry. I think we need to talk about Inside Out. Justin and I have seen Inside Out, and I think we're going to give our report to Elliot so he can determine, well, he's probably going to see it, but determine how enthusiastically he goes to see it.
I would love to see this movie. I mean, I'm number one just because I am a company man, you know, loyal to Disney, people that pay my paycheck and provide me with a job.
Am I the only one who remembers when Pixar was competing with Disney?
No, I remember.
Like, I don't look at Pixar and think, oh, they're a Disney company. I just think Disney bought Pixar because Pixar was kicking their butt.
Well, I don't think that's the entire truth of the matter. It's pretty complex and we don't have anywhere near enough time to get into that. But so, Justin, do you want to go first?
Yeah, Daniel, this is one of those times where I think you need to explain to me what the fuck Pixar was doing, because this is the problem I have with this movie is it was exactly what I was afraid of going into it. Now, the first thing I'm going to say is, beautifully creative, beautifully animated, beautifully acted. The casting was perfect. Lewis Black as Anger, Mindy Kaling as Disgust, Richard Karn's character was perfect. Everyone was perfectly in their role. So I can't fault anything from a production standpoint. The writing was very economical. There wasn't anything introduced that wasn't used later. Everything had its purpose. Everything paid off. So I can't get mad at it from a production standpoint. It's an enjoyable movie. I think it's worth seeing. Now, I would never see it again for one simple reason. It was very difficult for me to watch at times. I nearly broke down and cried for a few times, but not for the reasons you were supposed to. Because to me, it was a very dark view of humanity, because I think it was emotions as cognition, and the little girl's personality was only defined as a reactive thing.
Yeah.
That was my response to the movie.
All right.
Can you talk me out of that? That is interesting. Daniel?
I'm not gonna talk you out of it, because this is the first Pixar movie I'm not gonna defend. This was the biggest hyped Pixar movie ever. I'm not exaggerating. Pixar has been making such a big deal out of this movie for years now, to the point where they were releasing papers about you know, people developed new theories of the mind because of working on this film. But in the end, it turned out to be a movie where Pixar was trying to demonstrate how smart they were. And for that and that only, I was not interested. The movie was a giant explanation. The movie was not a narrative in the same way that Finding Nemo is a narrative, or even Brave, which gets nailed as the worst Pixar movie. This was a giant explainer about how Pixar thinks the brain works. Okay, interesting, not a children's movie, almost not a movie, in my opinion. And it was compounded by the fact that I went with Faiza, my fiance, who like 15 minutes in, and then every 5 minutes after that was like, oh my God, is it over yet? This is the most boring thing I've ever watched in my life. And that was actually echoed by, I think we heard at least three different children in the theater beg their parents to go home.
Oh,
because
no.
They were so bored.
Oh,
by
no.
The movie.
It was just sort of predictable. I mean, it hit all the normal beats. Like, I knew what was going to happen because it was sort of, like I said, the writing was economical, but it was also predictable. So it's funny that you say that they wanted this new theory of the mind, where to me this was just like they distilled down the typical version of what everyone has thought in the movies that are made. I mean, to me, the only thing keeping this from being naturalism was at one point Joy has an epiphany and makes a decision. But that's the only decision that's really made the entire movie, isn't it?
Yeah, it's funny that the emotions make decisions to some degree. I mean, anger makes the decision to put in that idea. But I hear you, because it feels like it's odd that the emotions are the ones making decisions.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I didn't really want to go into too many spoilers because Elliot hasn't seen it, but that's what I mean by emotion as cognition. Things happen. So what happens is there's a headquarters where all the emotions are at a panel.
There's walkers in the barn and Lori's pregnant.
And something happens and they all decide what to do. And they all decide what to do to make her joyous. And Joy is the de facto leader at that point. And then if there's an idea, all an emotion does is say, I have an idea, and they take a light bulb that looks like, you know, the typical idea light bulb and stick it in the panel, and that's an idea. And the only time thought is talked about two other times in the movie. One, where there's the quote-unquote train of thought that runs through the girl's head, which is a train, but they never explain what the train of thought does or how it informs the emotions or anything. And then they also have, like, the abstract thought layer that they go on, but that's nothing more than a sight gag. And it was very visually compelling, but they never explain the interaction between thought and emotion.
Sight gag? It was a dissertation on what Pixar believes abstract thought is. Sadness, who is, like, the intellectual one in this, was spewing out this philosophy that I'm sure every child in the theater was going, Mom, she's saying big words and it hurts. Can we go home?
But see, I just took that. It was nonsense. It's when these people try to sound smart and they're just talking word salad. What they were saying didn't actually say anything.
I just felt like the entire movie was a series of explanations. And it never, like, to me, this was the setup for a movie. Maybe we can see a movie now, Inside Out 2, where something happens now that we know what the hell is going on.
Well, that was my other problem, is they were so obviously pandering for a sequel at the end now, because now Pixar knows they can make sequels. You know, there's Finding Dory, there's Cars 2, they're making all sorts of sequels. They put up at the end so many things that were like, sequel, 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 that it was kind of sickening.
Yeah.
I also didn't like, and here's something else I didn't like, the way they portrayed when they were in the head of the husband and the wife briefly. At the dinner table, I didn't like how they portrayed the man and the woman either. I thought that was super, super stereotypical.
The woman being thoughtful and caring, and the guy not paying attention and loving sports.
Right, and just like basically lying and making shit up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't like that at all. I thought that was super offensive.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like I'm trashing on this and people are gonna get the perception that I really thought this was a fucking awful movie. And they'd be right. No, I'm kidding. It's not an awful movie. It's interesting. But for me, that is a really low rating for a Pixar movie. Because Pixar movies, in my mind, are some of the best movies being made in history, really. And this did not come anywhere close to the standard I'm used to. It just got to like the level of, oh, okay, well, I saw that. All right.
And I wouldn't even go as far as to call it interesting. Like I said, it was creative. It was good to look at. I liked seeing how they concretized all the different parts of the brains and everything. And I thought, wow, this is going to translate really easy to a Disney theme park. And I think maybe they had a little bit of that in mind when they were doing it, or at least a Disney dark ride where you go through all these different little lands and stuff. So, you know, I appreciated that, but it wasn't interesting to me. I just think, I think the thoughts in it were very conventional. I really do believe it was emotionalism and it was emotion as cognition. And that's why it was tough for me to watch. Cause all I saw was reaction to the world, not any sort of any of the characters going out and pursuing their values. They were all just reacting to the external stimuli provided to each other, by each other, other people.
Yeah, indeed. So, kind of a swing and a miss for Pixar. Maybe their first one, Brave, kind of, Cars 2, maybe. I don't think I'll need to see this one again. Certainly, I won't need to own it, which makes me sad. But, you know, that being said, there's another Pixar movie coming out this year. Thanksgiving. So they have a chance to redeem themselves.
Is that The Good Dinosaur?
Yes.
I thought it was interesting in the title for The Good Dinosaur, they underline the word the. I don't know, it was just strange. It's like The Good Dinosaur. It's not The Good Dinosaur, it's the, like there's one dinosaur that's good. I don't know.
Huh. So Elliot, we thoroughly depressed you.
No, I'm glad that to hear your thoughts on it. I'm still going to go see it, you know, because I need to know, you know, what my company is putting out there. But I have to say, after Tomorrowland being such a disappointment, and because that, I mean, it really did flop in the box office, and I haven't seen it yet. But I mean, just the way that people, the lack of enthusiastic response to it. And now Inside Out, even though it's made a lot of money this weekend, but hearing your opinions on it and here, I don't know. I don't know what's going on. I love the company I work for, and I grew up watching some of the best animated films that have ever been made have come from Disney. And in fact, I would argue that most of the best animated films have come from Disney in my lifetime. And it's just really disappointing that a lot of this is happening right now.
What was the trailer the other one? That was by the people who did Frozen and Big Hero 6.
Frozen and Big Hero 6. It wasn't Zootopia.
Yeah, was that it?
Was that one?
I don't know. But Zootopia looked interesting, although it did look like it might just be conventional. I don't know. It was an interesting trailer.
Yeah.
Anyway, can we talk about Lava for a second?
Yeah, can we?
What did you think of that? Lava was, of course, they always do a short beforehand, which kind of annoyed me because I was like, I just watched trailers for fucking half an hour. I want to watch the goddamn movie. But what did you think of that?
Shut up. I love shorts.
Yeah, so, yeah, I will
eat my shorts.
because sometimes Pixar shorts are the best thing I've ever seen in cinema. But this one was almost grating. And again, like, it certainly didn't resonate with the audience because kids were like, I don't get it. Like, very openly, like, mocking it. And
so I'm going to spoil this one.
There's walkers in the barn and Lori's pregnant.
Because my reaction to this was very interesting because I've been, I think I've been destroyed by quote-unquote taking the red pill. So the whole basic point of it is there's this island that's a dude. And he's singing this song about, like, he wants to find a love one day because he'll lava them. Because lava means love, apparently, because it's so fucking creative and original. And he sings the song for so many years until basically he's, all his lava is gone. So he's right above the surface of the ocean. And right when he's above the surface of the ocean, the female volcano is almost about to break through. So she comes above and he falls below. And then she starts singing and he comes up again. So, first of all, I have two problems with this. One, from
male disposability?
Yes, that's the second problem. Thank you. The first problem is that's just fucking, it's a manufactured conflict. Like, there's no reason for this to happen. There's no explanation as to why he has to disappear and come back up again. It just seems like, why couldn't they have met in the middle and been like, hey, now we can both grow together? And then that leads into the second thing. Why the fuck did the guy have to go below the water in order to get the woman and almost die? Like, I don't understand. This seems like, I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into this, but that was my fucking thought. I was, like, offended. I was like, what the fuck?
I've identified now why Justin is not getting any women. It's because he's not willing to, quote, go below the water.
Right. It's not, it's not what I meant. The going below the water here was a metaphor for death. Okay?
Crazy.
A metaphor for death.
Justin, I think you need to work on your going below the water skills.
No, I don't. I actually enjoy it quite much. So I just want to be clear about that. But the point is, why?
All women listening who might be interested.
Why did he have to almost die? Why?
I think he almost had to die because he had the most bizarre tenor voice for a mountain I've ever heard. And why Pixar broke the convention of having mountains be deep, sort of bassy voices, I don't understand. Because he started singing and I was like, ah! That's coming out of him? Stop it.
It's like Jack Johnson did the whole thing.
This was my least favorite Pixar short ever. Ever! Ever! That includes the cloud one.
It's Cloud City!
So, I didn't get it. I thought it was kind of stupid. I don't know.
I thought it was volcano disposability. And speaking of volcano disposability and male disposability and being disappointed, it's time for TV with JML. Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. Focused on. All right, gentlemen. So, I know neither of you watch Game of Thrones, correct?
No. Absolutely not.
You're not.
Daniel, why do you not watch Game of Thrones?
I don't need to watch people get castrated and raped every episode.
So, how would you classify the show?
What style would
you say it is?
I think it's supposed to be a fantasy, isn't it? It's supposed to be like Lord of the Rings-esque, but you're showing fucking rape and castration and torture and horrible murder every episode to the point where people are reporting that they're throwing up during various scenes. That seems kind of naturalistic to me to be a fantasy.
Okay, and that was my always sort of tension with the show, was I could never sort of reconcile the fact that it seems very naturalistic with all of like the good production value and the fantasy elements of it. But, and I'm going to go into some major spoilers here for people who haven't seen Game of Thrones, the season finale. So, tune out now or just fast forward to when we're talking about something awesome in a couple seconds. Finally, I have the evidence for why Game of Thrones is naturalism. So, I'm sure there's a character you guys have all heard of. Have you all heard of Jon Snow?
He's the wall guy.
Right, yeah. And he knows nothing, right?
Yeah.
Well, he knows naturalism now, because the last scene of the season of this character who's been built up to be a big hero since the beginning of the show, the last scene of the season is people lure him out, and he's Lord Commander of the Night's Watch. The other members of the Night's Watch lure him out with a lie, and then they all stab him, and the season ends with him bleeding out.
Yay. What a payoff.
Right. And the point is, you know, in naturalism, what? Anyone can die at any time, right? So that's the point, is they emphasize randomness and twists over any sort of overall meaning. And this is so bad that this happened in the books. So there have been theories going on for years about Jon Snow actually being brought back to life or actually not being dead, because people don't want to believe that it doesn't have meaning. So, knowing the general culture, I think that it's not going to have meaning and he's not going to come back to life. Would you guys tend to agree?
I mean, I guess. I don't know if that kind of thing happens regularly on the show, but knowing George R.R. Martin, I would say that he's fucking dead.
Right, nobody's come back from dead on the show, although there is one who's a zombie in the books, but nobody else has come back.
There are zombies?
The White Walkers are sort of zombies.
I'm so glad I don't watch this shit.
Anyway, the point is they built up all this stuff with him and having all this significance. He's the only one who knows how to kill a White Walker now. He did it with his sword like two episodes ago or last episode, and then they kill him in the next. So to me, Game of Thrones has just pretty much shown its naturalism, and really the only reason to watch at this point is Tyrion, and then once they kill him to be done with it. So Game of Thrones, great production value, you know, great, again, casting, great acting, but in much the same way of Inside Out, it's not really worth a second watch, and if you have other things to do and better things to watch, I think it's worthwhile to watch those things instead. Speaking of, Daniel, I think I convinced you of something, didn't I?
Yeah. And it wasn't to stop drinking. You convinced me to watch Hannibal. And boy, did I. So I had some time where I was supposed to be relaxing and doing some writing of an upcoming book, which is 99.8% finished and ready to go. And so I decided to put Hannibal on. And I was going to do what I do with most shows, which is put it on and just sort of quasi-listen and watch. And I found myself not being able to do that because I actually wanted to watch it thoroughly and intently because it is so damn good. Or at least it was. Dun dun dun. Twist for Justin. So I thought season one of Hannibal, which I finished fairly quickly, it's 13 episodes, was just thoroughly and unequivocally outstanding. It was beautifully integrated. The characters were interesting. The sort of twist at the end was not entirely foreseeable. I thought just everything fit together perfectly. And I was so excited for season two. And then season two started off just as good. Like the first, I don't know, four episodes or five episodes were outstanding. It continued with the themes in the last bit. And then it just became fragmented and completely disjointed, and the characters became less compelling, and it became like Mad Men. Not that Mad Men is disintegrated, but it became so plodding, and it didn't move the plot along fast enough.
Well, part like of the challenge the second half of season two faced was the whole thing is this, is Will Graham bad or not question? And they had to walk the line with that. And that means they couldn't progress it too quickly and make it too obvious. They were trying to make him seem as methodical as Hannibal. Because the way Hannibal usually works as a show is you have the overarching sort of design that Hannibal has, which is, you know, that's the main quote of the show, is this is my design. And then Will Graham is weaving in and out of that throughout the season, trying to solve all these small crimes that add up to the overall slow burn plot. And that's what worked so well in season one. But in season two, they tried to have Will Graham integrate himself into that slow burn plot, which made it difficult to show the entire season or to pace it out well. I actually had more of a problem with the first half of the season where I was just like, can we just fucking get Will Graham out of prison, out of the mental asylum?
Well, I didn't so much like that, but it worked fine for me after it got going a little bit. Maybe after the first two episodes, it sort of got into a groove. It's just after he comes out of the asylum and it's that they're going to set this trap for Hannibal, it just becomes scene after scene of two characters sitting talking to each other. Just scene after scene of conversations. Like, I understand that that's important and you're trying to play a show about psychology, but please, something should happen in between those scenes. And it just never did.
Okay, like, well, you're actually ironically one episode ahead of me now, which is the greatest fucking irony in the entire world. There have been three episodes in season three, and I just watched episode two, and I'm planning to watch the third one tonight. But you're one episode ahead of me. What do you think of season three so far? Because I thought the first episode was phenomenal. I haven't really digested the second episode yet, but I thought it was pretty good. I thought it was – I had more of a problem with the production on that one because it was so dark. I had trouble seeing stuff. And I don't know about you, but I have a trouble with the audio mix sometimes.
Oh, my God.
The background is so loud, but Will Graham wants to whisper the whole time. So I have to keep rewinding to see what Will said.
I had to start watching with closed captioning. That's – if I have one giant complaint about the show, it's that whoever decided to do the audio mixing, they're – literally, they whisper to each other.
Yeah.
In giant halls. Like, they're standing 40 feet apart, whispering to each other, and then this sort of 20th century classical music comes in of clanking pots and pans that is 500 decibels louder than what they were just saying.
Yeah, so I turned it up really loud.
I have to mute my television.
Yeah, I turned it up really loud for the dialogue, and then for the sound effects, I have to turn it down.
It is a workout for your thumb if you do that. Yes.
But what'd you think of the first three episodes? Or let's just do the first two because I don't want spoilers.
Ooh, don't want to spoil it for you. Mm-hmm. Good introductory episode. I think, you know, this season being a little bit more about Hannibal is a good thing since it's named Hannibal. Second episode, like Will Graham is starting to become an uninteresting character to me. When he was doing his thing and he was sort of borderline crazy, I was cool with that. Now that it's like, he might be fucking crazy now. I don't care about Will Graham anymore.
Yeah.
Suddenly I care about the real crazy guy in the same vein as I do in Game of Cards. Why can't I name things today?
House of Cards.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's I don't care about the piddly politicians. Give me the mastermind.
Yeah, and that's the difficulty with the doing a long series of this. Is the whole point of the series is it's good versus evil, right? Where Will is good and Hannibal is evil, and it's all about how evil tempts good and, you know, gets in there and tries to pervert them and manipulate them and convince them they're actually evil. But how many times can you do that with Will before you're like, I've seen that plot already.
Right.
And they did that on season one, and then they went with it even more in season two. And now we've seen, I mean, I haven't seen episode three, so I can't say about that, but in the second episode, they seem to be playing with that idea already, except it was more PTSD for Will of what had happened in the season two finale. So now we've sort of moved from, is Will gonna become evil and a killer like Hannibal, or now we're just, is Will just fucking broken? Because he has PTSD from what Hannibal did to him. Like, I don't even know what he's trying to do with Hannibal anymore. I mean, that was a question the Italian guy raised, right? The Italian inspector, he's like, what are you going to do when you find Hannibal?
And he's the worst stereotypical Italian actor ever. It's like, what are you going to do when you find the Hannibal? It's like,
it sounded more Asian than it did.
Because like, he's terrible!
It sounded like Ling Ling's dad is what that sounded like.
That's what, because he's a fucking awful actor.
But that's
we have these series of tremendous actors and then this doofus they brought on screen.
That's sort of the question of the first half of the season, I think. We're supposed to want to know what Will Graham's going to do when he meets up with Hannibal, which I'm sort of surprised about. They've sort of fast-tracked the plot. And I want to know what's going to happen with Jack and Alana. Like, are they just not in the show anymore, even though they're in the opening credits? So.
And what happened to Cancer Wife?
Oh, anyway. Yeah. What happened to Zoe from... what's her name from Firefly?
I will sell it to the audience and to Elliot like this, which is, it is beautifully, beautifully directed and written and plotted in a very romantic way. Everything is conceptual and choice driven and just stunningly done in a way where you could take this show about murder and horror and just go all the way naturalistic, especially in today's culture, and Brian Fuller does not. It is so artistic and so conceptual that it makes it completely worth watching. At least the first season.
All of it's worth watching. It may not be the greatest in season two, but think of it this way. It's romanticism and it's well done romanticism, even if it's not done as to the capacity that it's proven it can be done to. So how much better is it than 95% of what's out there?
Fine. It's a good point.
Even in season two. So let's not make Daniel think it's Inside Out here. But Daniel, let's not make people think it's Inside Out here. It's worth seeing, and it's worth repeat viewing.
Maybe. It's certainly season one, for me, at least.
All right. Well, when we're talking about not knowing if things are crazy or not, that means we can only do one thing. It's time for Reddit on Reddit.
Sony stupid, Xbox lame, PC gaming all the way. EA blows, Steam rocks, God rest for my Firefox. These things are all on Reddit. Mostly pics of felines, comma, whoring felines. These things are all on Reddit. No, we didn't post it, but we will repost it.
First Reddit, and this is in brackets discussion. Depression, anxiety, loneliness, a breakup. I don't want anything anymore, but if I am to survive, I have to. What do I do? I love how that reads like a goth poem.
I have to what? What does he mean? I don't want anything anymore, but if I am to survive, I have to. He has to want in order to survive?
Yeah.
Is that what he says?
Yes, that's what he's saying. So how does he make himself want things again is what he wants to do, what he wants to know.
Elliot?
Yeah, we haven't heard from you, Elliot.
Send him to therapy, is probably what I would say.
Not Hannibal Lecter.
That's the only thing I could possibly say. Look, I mean, the things that you want, I mean, we all have our basic needs, you know what I mean? We have the food, warmth, shelter, water, companionship. I mean, these are kind of basic values.
Wi-Fi.
Yeah, Wi-Fi.
Yeah. Thank you, UN.
It's just, these are the kind of basic things that you need. And once those are met, and because we, you know, for the longest time, we were a capitalist country with a free market, we are past that. Now there are regions in the world where people don't even have water and there's a scarcity of food. And, it's because they are not free. And I'm not trying to make this a political statement, but what I'm saying is that you live in a country where there are a lot of things, not just to want, but things to create, opportunities to pursue, travels and journeys that you can take, you know. So the idea that I don't, you know, that this person doesn't want anything, if that's genuinely true, then you need to see a therapist. I mean, and talk to somebody about that. At least that would be my recommendation. But I don't know this dude. I don't know who posted this question. And if he's just being a stupid, whiny emo kid and not being serious about this, then I would just say, you know what? Grow up. You'll heal and you'll find other things to do. The world is full of values. All right. Sometimes you have to create them. Sometimes you have to seek them out. Sometimes you have to trade for them, but the world is full of values. So stop whining.
Who thought Elliot would give the harshest advice among us?
It is. It's harsher awesome. Than I'm going to give.
It's awesome. I fucking love it.
No, it's because I know people who struggle, genuinely struggle with depression as a chronic issue. I mean, their brain is just, they have issues there and they struggle with it, but they're living, you know, and they're doing things, they're achieving things and, they inspire me, you know. When I get down about something, I look at them and I say, I have no right to complain about anything when they have it worse because they really don't have control over what their brain does sometimes. It's just a chemical imbalance and it's a chronic condition in a way. So I mean, people like this who they're talking about a heartbreak or ending a relationship. I'm like, sorry, no, I don't sympathize with you because I know people who really genuinely battle depression and they are coming through it and they're living with it and they're overcoming it in a million small different ways. So I have no sympathy for people like this.
All right there, Sergeant Elliot. Let the emotionalist step in here for a minute and help this poor sap out. Jeez, put him in a concentration camp already.
You must be talking about yourself, because I'm not an emotionalist, so.
Generalissimo Elliot?
Really? You should have gone with Generalissimo Rivera.
Yeah, I didn't
know. I missed that title.
Okay. Yeah, I generally agree with Elliot, but I will say something nicer for the sake of diversity.
Pussy.
For the sake of diversity, you're off the podcast. Whoever says that on this podcast?
It's our number one value here, or so I hear. Okay, so see a therapist is good advice. I think everyone in the entire world should see a therapist in the same way that they see a physician regularly for regular checkups. But if barring that, it will get better. What's that gay phrase? It gets better. Like it does. Is that what they tell young gay kids? It gets better. It does get better.
Thing? Elliot, is that a gay thing?
Yeah, there was a movement when all those gay teen suicides were happening. They started a movie called It Gets Better, which I don't necessarily like because in my mind it doesn't get better. You have to make it better. But
well, yeah, that's the whole thing of because you're a nerd and picked on in high school, you're going to be rich and happy when you're an adult, right? They tell people that. Don't worry, everyone hates you now. You'll be fine later.
So don't do anything.
Right.
But I mean, it gets better in the sense of when you're, especially when you break up with someone that you really cared about, it's gonna hurt. That's just the nature of things. That's the way your brain works. And over time, it will get better. Yes, you have to actively work on it. But even if you don't, even if you put it sort of like in the passenger seat, it'll eventually get better over some amount of time. I think if you genuinely work on it, if you push yourself to accept it and think through all of your emotions, like even the worst kind of breakups, it's going to be 3 to 4 months. And that sucks, but it will get better. One thing I would suggest is if you're having a hard time fully thinking about whatever it is you're dealing with, try to write it down. Even if it's not something you share with anyone, just write down your thoughts as they come to you, almost stream of consciousness, because sometimes concretizing them on paper will help you get a better grasp on what it is you're actually going through and what it is that's actually making you depressed or sad. So that's my advice.
Generally, though, I do agree with you guys. I think it's good advice, but I'm going to concretize this in a little bit different of a way. You know, Dan, you're saying write it down. Elliot, you're saying go to therapy. I'm going to say get off Reddit. And what I mean by that is deal with reality. Right? We have this idea in the society that if you talk to another person, and actually that was also in Inside Out, if you remember, that was sort of the suppressed premise in there of how do you get over sad things? Well, you talk to other people about it and they make you feel better.
Yes, sadness brings other people.
Yeah, sadness.
Which is why sadness is good.
Right. I hated that. I was like, so the only reason people are ever going to have sympathy for you and like you is if you're sad? I was like, that's fucking pathetic. Don't even, like I said, it was a very dark view of humanity. It made me cry, almost cry. My eyes were welling up. Anyway, the point is, you know, we think now that the internet's here, oh, if we just put it into the nebulous internet, people will respond to us and that will make us feel good and that will give us the answer. And I say this from experience, from when I was young and I was lonely and upset that I was lonely and dealing with issues like this. Not breakups, because I didn't date anyone because I was lame. But
Justin was literally limping on crutches. He was lame.
So I was in a chat room all the time because I was limping. No, you know, I just lack certain skills and certain knowledge. So I understand the mentality of, oh, if I post it on Reddit, they'll tell me how to feel better. Nobody can tell you how to feel better but you. If you really just went through a breakup, that means you have lots of free time you didn't realize you had, or you don't realize you have, because you were dedicating it to that other person. Use that free time to do whatever the fuck you want. You can do whatever you want now. There's nobody telling you in the world what to do. That's it.
Spending your money.
Yeah, and you can spend it on your own stuff, like Lego Iron Buster and a Mr. Toad's Wild Ride t-shirt.
And a Superman hoodie.
I haven't bought that yet, but I probably will end up buying that. It's an awesome Man of Steel hoodie.
Oh, it's Man of Steel? Cool.
Yeah, by the way, I have a Adam Carolla advice, which is whenever anyone asks him about what they should do after a breakup or when they're feeling sad, he says, do some push-ups, go for a walk, and listen to classical music. You'll be fine.
The going for a walk does help. I can't particularly do push-ups right now, but
I think it just generally means exercise, better yourself, listen to classical music, you'll be fine.
Right, so he's saying the same thing I am. Do something, get out in reality.
Yeah.
A friend of mine told me that if you ever go through something emotionally tumultuous, you know, that or something that's really like weighing on you, depressing you, redecorate your room. Just seriously, take all the furniture, just move it around. Just the act of moving things around gives you a sense of control, apparently. Yeah. And it gives you an ability to just kind of think for solutions and towards outcomes rather than just moping around.
Exactly, because I think when something like this happens, you feel like it's out of your control and no progress is being made, especially if you go through it for a couple years and that, like, you have a relationship for a couple years and it ends, you're like, fuck, all my progress is gone. So if, you know, you go for a walk or you buy things for yourself or you rearrange your room, you're showing yourself concretely that progress can be made again, and you're reminding yourself that you have made progress and your progress isn't just about the other person. Next Reddit. T-I-F-U, which means today I fucked up by being a creep. And I'm going to read this little blurb here because I think this is fucking funny. This is happening as we speak. Pause. What did we just say about getting off? What did I just say about getting off of Reddit? Maybe you can solve this problem by, I don't know, not being on Reddit. Unpause. I'm at a wedding. Pause again. If I'm ever on Reddit during a wedding, kick me out of the wedding.
Go fuck a bridesmaid. Get off Reddit.
The bridesmaids aren't always cute.
Yes, and Justin.
Oh, I'm gonna be a groomsman at a wedding coming up here, and I just don't want that pressure on me because I've seen the pictures of the bridesmaids and I don't want anything to do with them, so.
Yes, and.
Yes, and unpause. Being the curious guy I am, I happen to see a girl who looks rather familiar. After a while, I realized that this girl had gone to my university and that we're mutual friends on Facebook. Pause. Does that mean they're friends with each other or they have mutual friends? I don't know. Anyway, unpause. I creep on her Facebook, swiping through photos when I accidentally tag myself in one of her photos and I don't know how to undo it. It says pending request. Pause. Now this is where it gets funny, ready? This guy picks the nuclear option. Unpause. Promptly deleted my Facebook and currently hiding in the bathroom. What? Is this one girl so important that you had to delete your Facebook and hide in the bathroom over it?
There are numerous other faux pas one could have committed that are about 1,000 times worse than this. But
such as,
like, I don't know, clicking like control paste and accidentally hitting enter when you have like a porn link stored on your computer or something, like, you know, or like typing in a comment like, man, I would totally do this girl, when you think you're typing in like a chat window to a friend and it's actually a comment on her picture. And you tagged yourself in a photo. So fucking what? Send her a message that says, hey, couldn't remember where I saw you or where I knew you from, so I was on Facebook and accidentally tagged myself. Sorry, that was weird.
But gentlemen, may I remind you, we live in the age of the feminist.
Well, yeah, I can understand, like, if he was afraid that
this man
would...
tagged himself in my photo. He raped my profile. That is an aggression. How dare he? Male privilege.
Well, okay, fine. That happens. Okay, I agree. That is a far more likely outcome than we would like to admit in today's society. But take it from us. We're dudes. You gotta be a dude. And just if she does that, just be like, you're a fucking bitch and leave her alone.
Exactly. I'm gonna take back my poke then.
You can still poke on Facebook. Did you know that?
Yes. Yes, I did know that.
The other day my boss was like, what's this poking thing on Facebook? And I was like,
don't do it!
I was like, from 2005? And then I searched it and I was like, you can still poke people? But anyway, this is my big problem with this. So, when you're at a wedding or any other social event, when you want to talk to a girl, the hardest thing to come up with is what? And nobody say their penis. The most difficult thing to come up with is what?
Damn it! It's like an introduction.
Right.
Like an icebreaker.
An icebreaker. But if you go, hey, didn't we go to the same school? I think I know you from somewhere. And she's like, oh yeah, I went to so-and-so. Where did you go? That's your icebreaker right there. Why would you go on Facebook to confirm that? Because even if you didn't go to the same school, you're already in a conversation with her.
Or there's an even easier icebreaker at any wedding, even if you don't want to lead with the I think I know you from somewhere thing, which is,
how do you know the bride and groom?
Yeah. which I got asked about 100 times at a recent wedding.
But see, that's why you don't want to do that, because everyone else is doing that.
But it's easy, because then from there you can go anywhere you want.
Or you can just...
How do you do that if you're in the wedding party, though? Can I do that at the wedding I'm going to?
You sneak a bottle of liquor from the open bar, tap the girl on the shoulder, and say, hey, yo, let's go this way.
To the bathroom. Mm-hmm. You're going to want to down this first.
What if somebody used that opener just in random places? They go up to somebody in the supermarket. Hey, how do you know the bride and groom?
I think that would be a hidden camera show. Called Wacky Icebreakers.
Yeah, I don't understand
Howie
this.
Mandel.
I don't understand this.
Yeah, this guy's an idiot. He deserves any and all embarrassment that comes to him.
Well, that's the worst part. He's feeling embarrassed over something there's nothing to feel embarrassed about. So not only is he inhibiting himself socially, but he's feeling embarrassed about something that there's no need to feel embarrassed about.
Yeah. Stop being a loser, you idiot.
Last Reddit. What villain lived long enough to see themselves become the hero? This is, of course, a reversal of the famous Dark Knight line, right?
Yeah.
We either die the hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
Yeah, like Jerry Sandusky.
Sure, yeah. Or Tom
Brady. Joke. Come on. He molested kids.
Yeah,
come on,
I get
it's
it.
A joke. Okay.
What about Tom Brady?
Well, Tom Brady's been the villain. That's not. When was Tom Brady the hero?
In my heart.
Well, of course. But
it's okay.
First one comes to mind. Play it called You Gay. Okay. First one that comes to mind for me is, of course, Darth Vader.
That's what I thought, yeah.
Yeah. Who, I mean, it is, essentially, Star Wars is the story of Darth Vader, who starts off as the potential savior, becomes the most evil villain in all of Evilville, and then eventually is redeemed. Right? So. There you go.
I was thinking Spike from the Buffy Angel series. I don't know if he ever truly becomes a hero, but I mean,
yeah, he does. The ending of the Buffy series finale was his heroic self-sacrifice.
But in Angel, when he comes back, he's reconstituted, and I mean, it's just an interesting thing because even though he is not the guy that he was before, he's not the same evil vampire before, but he still had that brash kind of competitiveness, you know, with Angel. But I think he's somebody who, I think made that transition to go from villain to hero. I would say Spike. Angel too. Angel, I would classify also.
Yeah, because he was Angelus and then he became Angel when he got his soul.
Yeah.
So apparently the answer is Joss Whedon things.
Kind of, yeah.
I have one from Lost.
Who?
Benjamin Linus in Lost.
Oh, interesting.
The way they did his plot. He definitely started out as a villain, and they, you know, they had him basically commit genocide and then somehow made the entire fan base love him anyways.
I love the way you forget about that. It's like, you can stay here and run heaven, guy who committed genocide.
Well, he didn't run heaven. He was just on his deathbed for a long time because he still had stuff. He still had to deal with the fact that he committed genocide. So Hitler's ultimate punishment is he just doesn't get to move on to heaven. He just sits on his deathbed in limbo, basically.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think who else. On Warehouse 13, what's her? H.G. Wells. She was a nut. And she became a really badass, like, awesome character in the end.
Yeah, that was I've never really understood that. That was sort of weird the way they did that. I think they just liked the actress a lot.
Yeah, I really like the character. I like the character a lot in the end, too.
There was a character named H.G. Wells?
You have to watch the show. It's on Netflix.
What happened was,
Don't tell him.
I'm gonna tell him because he's never gonna watch it.
Never gonna watch an episode.
I'm kidding, you're missing out. You don't even know.
The only reason to watch Warehouse 13 is Claudia's hot, okay? Let's be serious.
I watch for Eddie McClintock, okay?
Well, that's what Google image search is for.
Right. So, anyway, the point is, in the Warehouse 13 mythology, H.G. Wells' brother actually published her fiction as her. So she was the one who actually experienced it and he published it.
Huh.
And she goes to work for the warehouse in its previous incarnation, And while working for them, she loses her daughter, which drives her mad, and they have to incarcerate her in bronze. In the series, she comes back. She's released by another villain, and she, for a period of time, she befriends Micah, the lead female on the series. They become very good friends, but then her madness kind of creeps back in, and she almost destroys the world. But she, over the course of the remainder of the series, as she's kind of re-establishing her identity and kind of coming back to grips with, grips on reality, she actually went to being kind of an invaluable asset to the team. And, she's a very, very well-written character, I thought, in that series.
Let's do another one. What about, the Cylons in the rebooted Battlestar Galactica? Didn't they start as the villain and then become co-heroes at the end?
Didn't watch it. Not gonna watch it.
Probably a good decision.
I guess you could say Age of Ultron. But I don't know. I kind of feel like Scarlet Witch is still a villain. I don't know why they forgave her so quickly.
Oh, that's right. She'd be one from villain to hero, right?
Well, in their world, in their minds.
Yeah, and she lived, like, what, 2 days?
Right. And she becomes a new Avenger.
Yeah.
Yeah, she didn't live very long for it either. That's true.
Yeah. Hitler? Hitler's another one.
In the producers, maybe. Sure.
Can we think of anyone from real life?
Villain who lived long enough to become the hero. Well, we haven't quite gotten to Ayn Rand yet, but that'd be nice.
Has it happened with anyone, though? Anyone?
I'm trying to think.
It probably is one of those things that happens on a personal level in a lot of million small ways that add up to a big whole. It's probably not something, especially in this day and age, that we publicized.
I've got a bizarre one. How about, like, Galileo?
That's exactly what I was thinking. Scientists who were reviled for their supposedly satanic or ridiculous beliefs, and then that later became accepted.
Yeah, Galileo was murdered as a heretic.
No, but he was a hero already. The world just didn't regard him that way until time passed.
Well, I think that's what the question is of. Right? What? I don't think it's necessarily the transition. I think it's the way other people perceive them. Because that's what the Batman quote's about, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Yeah. I mean, Galileo would be my vote, but...
Well, the question seems to imply a disassociation. To see themselves become the hero. So that implies a...
Well, don't read into the see themselves. That's just bad grammar. Because they didn't want to choose him or her. It should be what villain lived long enough to see himself become the hero or herself become the hero.
No, but what I mean is the disassociation of seeing yourself become a hero rather than choosing to act heroically or to take steps that others would conceive to be a hero, so.
Right, it's based on perception.
Oh, I mean, I get Elliot's point though, which is that Galileo didn't live long enough to see himself become the hero.
Right. No, I agree. That's
he
why
died.
Your example is wrong. Right. Yeah. It's a question of perception, it's not self-perception, it's others' perception of you. So it's a second-handed question, Reddit. Get off of Reddit!
Where will we get our final segment?
I don't know. We'll figure it out, it's the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we got annoyed by ESPN or something, I don't know. Alright. Let's zip this episode up. What did we learn this week? Daniel?
I learned that we need to treat objectivists as individuals. The irony.
Are you being snide?
A little. But it is a good reminder always, isn't it?
Yes, it's always a good reminder to treat people as individuals. I think especially where this manifests the most is in dating. Treat the people you're meeting as individuals, not as the same thing as all the other people you've met before. And this goes on both sides of the gender aisle. Women who have been mistreated by men and men who have dealt with bitches. Not every girl's a bitch, not every guy's an asshole. Every person is an individual.
You forgot pussy.
Whatever.
It makes the Team America an asshole.
Yeah, I get it.
Okay.
Elliot?
I learned that Game of Thrones is definitely not a show that I'm going to be very interested in watching ever. Ever.
What'd you learn, Justin?
I learned that even though I'm going to be a groomsman and should know how everyone knows the bride and groom at the wedding, I now have an opening for when I talk to everyone at the wedding. So, how do you know the bride and groom? I'm going to go up to my parents and say that.
Hashtag, how do you know the bride and groom on Twitter?
Thanks. Oh, I'm going to use that during the wedding. I'm going to live tweet the wedding now, the wedding reception. I'm going to use that. I'm going to take Instagram photos and put them on Instagram with hashtag, how do you know the bride and groom?
Yeah, it's true. It's great. Well, if you know the bride and groom, why don't you tell us about it? A little iTunes review, just a little something on the iTunes review.
Or help us give a wedding gift to them by supporting our Patreon. Disclaimer, true. The funds will not go to the wedding gift.
It's like colleges, though. When you give us money, we don't use that money for the thing you tell us to use it for, but we displace money we would have already used. So it's like, you know, here's $10,000 to the music department. We don't give a new $10,000 to the music department. We just say the $10,000 we were going to give you, we're replacing it with this new money. So that's kind of how it's going to work with patreon.com/themidside. We're going to displace that money and use it for hookers and blow. But, I mean, if you're okay with us getting hookers and blow, why don't you throw in a few pennies? You know, 50 cents, 25 cents, 25 bucks, whatever you got. We'll take it. Facebook.com/midside, Twitter.com/midside, all that stuff. Thanks. We love you. Tell a friend. Woo! Woo!
I'm Justin M. Lesneski, and I hope you learned something this week. This concludes your journey into the midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.
Sorry, yeah, I'm going to talk in a second, but I was just worried there was an earthquake for a second. Sorry, there's a weird noise, and I was like, is that what an earthquake sounds like?
You should check Twitter.
Twitter would be the first to know.
Indeed, if the earthquake starts something like, it's something like if the earthquake starts 5 miles or more from you, it's likely that you'll find out on Twitter before you find out in real life.